Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm glad to hear that you're doing great. I'm also doing well. So.
All right. Well, I think we got a terrific show lined up tonight. We lined it up here in about the last 30 seconds, I'm thinking, right before the show started. But sometimes we get our inspiration earlier, sometimes later, and that's okay. That's a beautiful thing about Fast Forward Radio. But as promised, we are going to be picking up our topic from last week. We did 2 weeks in a row on energy. 2 weeks ago, we had Brian Wong on the program talking about possible energy futures. Last week, we continued that discussion amongst ourselves and got into this interesting kind of side discussion, thanks to our friends in the chat room, about what will it take for us to turn the corner on energy, and not just energy, but on a lot of the changes that we want to make going into the future. So we're going to spend some time on that. But before we do, let's introduce our chat host, Sally Morham. Sally, how are you?
Oh, hi. I'm great tonight. Fantastic.
Great. All right. Well, we're gonna keep working on you until you're super fantastic, Sally.
Oh, okay.
That's to work on that. Our goal for you and for everyone in the chat room. So I want you to know that you and the chatters did a great service last week, provided a lot of content in the program, and gave us our topic for this week. So thank you, and thanks to all your friends in the chat room, and you guys keep up the good work. I'm going to be calling on you frequently throughout this program because this is... this is big stuff we're getting into tonight.
Absolutely.
All right.
Hope you're ready. Okay.
Some good stuff, yeah. Before we get into our main topic tonight, Phil, I wanted to get into this this interesting story about the Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah. Well, so what's going on with that anyway? I understand they've shut it down again.
Yeah, there's been one incident after another shutting it down. It's getting to the point. There's been this rumor going around, and that, you know, what's happening here is that if they were ever to actually turn it on, it would end the world, and therefore we've got time traveling particles coming back, disrupting the time continuum, keeping it from being able to be turned on, so that the world will not end. So,
and could I actually say, that's not just a rumor. I mean, that is a scientific theory, and now work has been published to that effect, right? Scientists have actually published a paper saying we think that's what's happening, right?
Well, you know, which kind of bothers me. What if they're wrong about these time traveling particles, but right that it will end the world? You know, I mean, so I'm thinking, you know, maybe we want to rethink the whole turning it on. But anyway, my favorite story so far about the trials and mishaps of the Large Hadron Collider has come out. It's interesting. A bird dropped some bread on a section of the outdoor machinery of the Large Hadron Collider, and led to significant overheating in parts of the accelerator. And you know, it's not going to be a huge problem. They're going to handle that issue quickly. But had it been on when this happened, it would have been a huge deal. And so it exposes yet another problem with. You know, it's just a very, very complex machine with lots. And when you have a complex machine, there's lots of ways it can break down. And so it exposes yet another issue with with it. So
bird drops a piece of, and as I read it, baguette, actually. So it's,
that's right. This is France, after all. So
probably had a little bit of brie smeared on there.
That's right.
And the only reason he dropped the baguette was because he was holding on tight to that glass of snappy white wine. He was
actually, you know, this being the show that it is, we have an exclusive. I've gotten right here a written copy of the bird's briefing of what happened, and so I thought to set the mood. Let's play a little music, and I'm going to read you this briefing. Okay.
Let's hear about it.
All right, here we go. The approach was not easy. I was required to maneuver straight down this trench and skim the surface. The target area was only 2 meters wide. It was a small thermal exhaust port right below the main port. A shaft led directly to the reactor system. A precise hit started a chain reaction, which should destroy the station. And
great shot, kid. That was one in a million.
That's right. And so that's the story of the Large Hadron Collider's latest mishap. So,
wow. Anyway. Love the music. Love the love the voiceover there too. So we can only hope that it was actually Harrison Ford himself providing the assist there when the bird dropped the bread. You know, what's interesting about that?
I can just imagine a French Darth Vader. I don't know. It's just a,
yeah, I don't know. That outfit's a little overstated. But this whole theory that...
maybe it'd be German.
Well, you know, there's a lot of ways you can go with that.
Sorry.
That the universe is kind of this closed system that won't allow it to happen. Now, if you know the tachyon's coming from the future, I mean, essentially, it's like, I don't know. There was a new version of the time machine a couple, 3 years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and that was the problem. Spoiler coming here: the reason he couldn't go back and change anything was because that was the only way he would be able to invent the time machine. So all his travels through time would have, you know, it was like it was preventing a paradox from occurring.
Right.
So it's like the
he couldn't save his fiancée.
Right, exactly. There's the actual spoiler stated outright.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't seen it by now, please go see it. It's a good movie.
Yeah, and you can't save her. So the point is, if the universe is this closed system like that, then we're safe because increasingly ridiculous things will happen. And I have to say that if we were living in that kind of universe, a bird dropping a piece of bread on it starts to sound like the kind of stuff you would expect to happen, you know. I mean, if even weirder stuff happens, then you kind of got to go, well, maybe there is something to that. But to your point, what if it's not a closed system, but it really will destroy the universe, right?
So, you know, we need to be careful about these things. I don't want to be anti-science at all. I'm very pro-science. But if we don't know what a thing will do, and there's a possibility of a catastrophic result, then, you know, maybe we should be careful, you know?
I think so. I think there's a case to be made for being careful. All right, well, let's jump into our show because we got a lot of ground to cover tonight, and we'll see how far we get with this. But to take it back to last week, we ended our discussion, as I said, about energy with kind of a quandary around, well, we know all this is doable. We know this is all possible. But how will we get from here to there? That's really the issue. And Stephen, you made the point that we're likely to have to go through a lot of pain before we make the right decisions.
I was addressing specifically energy, but you know, I guess it could be applied to pretty much a lot of points about what we got to do in the future. So, you know, I mean, the developments that need to be made. You know, sometimes you have to go through the pain in order to have the inspiration to do something about the thing that's causing the pain. So maybe that's it.
Yeah, you would think with something, for example, like life extension, it's like we've all kind of been going through the pain forever. So
yeah,
maybe we're sufficiently motivated. We'll pick up the ball on that and just...
Yeah, who hasn't lost a grandparent or a parent or...
Yeah, a parent or a friend, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, what has to happen? How do people have to change? And I think you actually have an interesting anecdote around your own involvement in not this process, but a process related to a similar set of decisions from your own life. So tell us about
it. Well, yeah, I made a quick trip to Washington, D.C. last week. I went to protest Obamacare, I decided it was interesting. I decided on the morning of Wednesday that I was going to do it, and it was the protest was to take place at noon on Thursday. And so,
wow.
Anyway,
so
I
flew then.
And obviously, I had to get on, you know, drive to Little Rock because that was the best and fastest way to do it was actually to drive 4 hours and then get on an airplane and go the rest of the way. Funny, my bag didn't make it, so I was basically there with the clothes on my back kind of thing. So, any rate, it was, I want to tell the audience, if you've never been to DC before, you need to go. It's, it is just a beautiful city. It's something to be proud of, for our country. And I would say the other thing to be proud of, there's many, many things to be proud of with our country, but another thing is that if you got a problem with how things are going, we live in a free country where you can, you know, approach the very seat of power and stand right there on the Capitol lawn and shout out what your you know, beef is. And I think, you know, our freedom of speech is something that is it needs to be exercised as much as possible, and it allows our system to be self-correcting. We can make, you know, we in the United States can make small adjustments to how things are going just by speaking up from time to time, and that's important because, you know, contrast that with the Banana Republic. Things are going to go the way the dictator says until the people just have enough. There's a revolution, and then pretty soon you got a new dictator. It's going in a totally different way, but he's also abusing the people. There's no adjustments at all until there's massive adjustments. There's no small course corrections, and in large part because the people have no say in how things are going in the country and can't even speak up. And so
contrast with here, where we can go vote on election day when
that's
we feel
right.
so inspired, go to Washington and tell them how we feel about things.
That's right.
Before a big vote by Congress, and every day, as you know from reading the blogosphere or watching the news, I mean, people are actively involved politically, giving their opinion, stating really offensive things about leadership, right, about the president,
right.
things you could never get away with saying anywhere else in the world. And that didn't start with the current administration, obviously, and nor did it start with the one prior to that or the one prior to that. It's been going on for
since the pamphleteers.
Quite some time.
Yeah, since the pamphleteers of the, you know, around our own revolution. But it was,
Not that I'm
a blogosphere is a great, and now podcasting is, it gives normal people a voice in ways that we'd never had before. So we have an exciting future coming in part because we all have the ability to speak up and argue with one another, and I think that's just a fantastic part of our freedoms that we have. So
now, question for you, Stephen,
since
we've address this, and I do want to remind our listeners that Stephen is expressing his personal views. These are not the views of Fast Forward Radio or The Speculist. We don't take political stances per se, except I take a kind of I'm above it all sort of a stance, which makes me feel really good. Having loaded the question adequately, do you think that even with the freedom that we have, and even with the process that we have, which obviously is superior to a lot of other systems that have been tried, do you think our political process will get us there?
I think our political process sometimes needs to get out of the way of our capitalist system. Sometimes I believe that the freedom of normal people to act, to pursue their own goals, and to act in their own self-interest, to the extent that they're free to do these things, that I believe is going to be more important to getting us there than some program out of Washington. So, there's my political statement for the show.
Okay, fair enough. So I'll take that as a no. And good, because I've got some other ideas in addition to politics for things we need to do. So,
okay.
actually, while we're on the subject, let's talk a little bit about let's spin it back around to energy and talk a little bit about that piece in Forbes.
Okay.
Now, the headline there, Obama can still save his presidency, we're not interested in that, and we're not interested in the politics of the piece, but there was something very interesting about specifically energy. And
right.
Speak to us about that.
Okay. Well, one thing he points out is he says, you know, and the subtitle under that is Step on the Gas. And he was referring to natural gas and that we as a country need to take advantage of these natural gas resources that we found. What we have located here in the last just few years is this tremendous resource of natural gas that would give us like a 90-year supply of energy for this country. We could basically become energy independent by using natural gas. And it's not, you know, it's not wind power that clean, but it's pretty clean. It's a whole lot cleaner than, say, burning gasoline or certainly, you know, loads cleaner than burning coal. So, you know, the idea in that particular piece, Obama get behind natural gas. He has not really been behind natural gas. He has a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction against fossil fuels, and that includes even the cleanest of the fossil fuels, which is natural gas. You know, to me, you know, if you feel that all fossil fuel is evil, well, go with the lesser of the evils, and let's get self-sufficient and help us balance our budget by using and not sending money overseas to buy petroleum.
Yeah,
that's
just
my thought on that.
One of the things we talked about last week was, you know, what'll give us the cleanest environment, the most energy with the cleanest environment. We talked about geothermal, and we talked about nuclear fission, and we talked about solar, and those are all great, would like to see us moving towards all of those, actually. Until we're there, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to burn a lot of oil, or alternatively, we could burn a whole bunch of natural gas, and we would improve the environment over what we would be doing, burning the oil, right?
Right.
And we would improve our situation economically. So it seems to me that this is one of the less painful and more obvious steps we could take.
Yeah, and you know, we get all sorts of neat side benefits too. I mean, the transportation costs of natural gas would be, you know, once you get the pipelines laid, is practically zero. You could have the natural gas just about coming straight out of the ground and going to the fueling stations, you know, I mean, by pipes. And also when you burn it in a car, it's so clean in the way it burns, it leaves so little residue behind that you could run those engines forever. You don't have the same problem with the gunk or buildup that you do with a gasoline powered engine.
Now, a couple questions on this real quick before we move quickly on. One is, it's a 90-year supply of natural gas at our current rate of consumption, but obviously if we start powering our vehicles off it, it's not going to last us any 90 years.
Well, I would think that you wouldn't, you know, we even if we decided we were going to power all our vehicles off of it, we couldn't turn that around even in 10 years.
Hmm.
You slowly adopt it where, you know, you know, you could perhaps in the mandate a certain amount of our 18-wheelers use it, and then just put it in the fueling stations on the interstate routes, compressed natural gas, and you get it started that way, and then it starts filtering down from there from these large 18-wheelers to smaller vehicles like you and I drive. So. That's it would take a while to convert, and so yeah, you don't have a 90-year supply.
Yeah, once we ramped up, we'd be burning through it faster than.
But you know what? I'm convinced that we haven't found it all either.
That's likely the case, and the thing is that would buy us time to switch over to other things.
Right, with like electric. I mean, ultimately, I think we'll be driving around electric cars, and we'll be getting our electricity from other sources. So
yeah. Natural gas electric hybrids that slowly evolve into electric cars. That seems like a good plan. In fact, we can have both gasoline and natural gas-powered hybrids that evolve into electric cars running at the same time have all the economic advantages that you were talking about. Well, I'm sold, and I think that's the right way to go. And moreover, I think that we could probably get there even quicker. We could, if we wanted to, if we had the will. Once again, we're talking about this question of what's it take to motivate us to make these kinds of decisions, and we've talked about John F. Kennedy and the Apollo program and all that kind of thing. To me, if you look back, the great lesson of Apollo, and probably really the great lesson probably of like the Normandy invasion, right, is that you can make just about anything happen in a very short period of time if you put the will behind it. If you make the commitment, and you simply will not accept any other substitute for the fact that you're going to do this thing.
But historically, when do we do this? We do it when
historically, interestingly, in Normandy, we did it when we faced an absolute existential threat.
Right.
Apollo, when we faced a perceived existential threat.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure that that Soviet dominance in space was really ever an existential threat, right?
Right. But we thought it was, and yeah. So. There was that, and then so basically it comes back to my pain idea. You know, I mean, we're either going to have to be feeling a lot of pain, or to the point that we think, you know, our country's going to collapse economically if we don't make some kind of change, or else, you know. So in order to do it quickly, we have to reach that point where we feel like there's an existential risk, or we evolve slowly. And evolving slowly sure is a lot. You know, we didn't all start carrying cell phones because we felt an existential risk. It just happened because, man, these things are cool, and it's great to have. And boy, changing our life for the better. This is great. So we all decided to, you know, we all slowly purchased them, and sure enough,
Fairly rapidly. That was a hugely fast transition, and these technological adoption cycles have been fast. And when you look at those occurring, you go, hey, well, what's the difference? No one ever said we choose to all have cell phones, right? I mean, you didn't need a big
by the end of this decade, yeah,
exactly. Yeah, Winston Churchill didn't have to make a speech. JFK didn't have to make a speech. It just happened, and the reason it happened is because it was pretty straightforward and easy to do, right?
Yeah. Right.
There was.
Well, natural gas cars, I mean, the technology is already in place. We already have, I've seen production vehicles, or actually, I don't know if they're in production, but they were examples, and they were running around on compressed natural gas. And so the technology is already developed.
Yeah, I think if you're not up against the big pain, if you're not up against the big threat, then there's an inflection point where if something provides sufficient benefit, and it's not too hard, right? I mean, nobody's mortgaging their house to buy a cell phone,
right?
Then they could do it, right? It was, you know, what if you had to work 20 years to save up to buy a cell phone, right?
Yeah.
The transition might have been a lot harder, right? We might have had a harder time getting there. In fact, I was saying something similar about the development of the internet in the discussion we had with Will Brown on the blog over the weekend. I'm not going to get into that, though, because I've got other stuff I want to do. So here's what I want to suggest, is that if you see enough benefit, right, that inflection point moves. You'll do more pain, you'll accept more pain for greater benefit. And I think the real issue that we have is that maybe people don't grasp what's possible. They don't actually have a good feel for what is out there.
Well, let me add to this. I mean, with adopting something like a natural gas vehicle, you've got a chicken and egg problem. No one's going to go out and buy a compressed natural gas vehicle now because there's no place to fuel it up, except for maybe if you have natural gas coming to your home and you fuel up in your own garage. Okay, but if you're out on the road, how are you going to make a long trip with a compressed natural gas vehicle right now? You can't because you can't find any stations. So what you got to have in these circumstances, you got to have really, you know, maybe some move by the federal government saying, okay, we're gonna give 100% tax write off to any gas station that spends the money to install compressed natural gas pumps, you know, something like that to spur the process on. And once you get that, and once you reach a certain critical mass, then people will start buying the vehicles.
Right. Or you might decide, if you're an informed person who's thought about these things, or an informed electorate, an informed public, an informed leadership class who's thought about these things, you might look at it and go, you know, that has so much work associated with it that we're going to go this other route.
Yeah,
we're going to use the natural gas to power our power infrastructure and stop using coal and some other stuff, and then we're going to, or I don't know, you know what? There ought to be some way to use natural gas to grow algae fuel. That's what I keep running that one around in my head. It's like, there's got to be a way to make that happen. Because then you get the nice liquid fuel, right? Go straight into the pumps we already have, and boom, you're there, right? But where we ended with the first show with Brian and where we started in the second show is this just smorgasbord of stuff, right? There's so many good ways we could go. You know, and we got talking about drilling technology. We ended up in this really interesting tangent about, geez, geothermal is a lot more promising than I think people realize. Nuclear fission has a lot more promise to it than I think people realize. Solar, according to Kurzweil, is going to save the world, and all these discussions are going to be moot in a few years because everyone's going to be using solar power, which is entirely possible. But which direction we take, which one of them we pick, I think, depends on people having the notion in their head that, in fact, we're in a very powerful position here, that there are a lot of good things out there, but we actually have to go out there and get them, right? We have to make up our mind that we're going to make this leap. And energy is one example of that. A lot of the stuff we talk about, life extension, nanotechnology, friendly AI, those all require that kind of effort. And I think increasingly what we need is for people to start to see those possibilities, to really grasp that future is out there and you don't want to miss it. You know, you can miss the future a couple of different ways, right? You cannot live to see it.
that's the worst possible way to miss the future, right?
Exactly. You know, the bus could hit you tomorrow. Please be careful, everyone. Or you can just not take the steps that you could have taken, and you get a different future. You miss the one
a less bright future. Yes.
Exactly. And we don't want to miss it. We want to hit the good one. Or one of the good ones, because there are an awful lot of good ones out there. And I've got a.
Can I give you a? This is a tangent, and I want to give it's potential good one.
Okay.
A potential good future. From Next Big Future, this is Brian Wong's blog again. He writes, main vessel for India's fast breeder reactor to be lowered mid November 2009. This is a type of fission reactor.
Mm-hmm.
That I'd never heard of a fast breeder reactor. What is a fast breeder reactor? It breeds more nuclear material for a fission reaction than it consumes. Now, that sounds like some sort of perpetual motion problem there, but apparently...
No, it's a breeder reactor, but it goes fast. It produces it in a... what's the time frame, does it say?
They're looking to have it operational by 2011.
Oh, cool. So it's a nuclear plant that creates nuclear fuel. So
as it's going, it's creating nuclear fuel as it's going. Maybe it's sort of like instead of producing nuclear waste, it's producing its own fuel as it goes. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. Of course, now you do get waste from a breeder reactor too. But you're right, you get fuel. Are they then going to? I guess since it's a fast breeder reactor, they're going to piggyback that into multiple new reactors in India. Is that the plan? Or
that is the plan.
That's very cool. Well, there you go. See, now India taking a big bite out of the possibilities there. Okay, they're going in the direction of nuclear because they've looked at options and they've been working towards this one. And they said, hey, here you go, fast breeder reactor. Let's get going on that one. And I think that's great. So here's my story. A few weeks ago, I'm on online trying to set something up in my DirecTV account. I can't remember what I was trying to do, but I was trying to set something up in my DirecTV account. And I have automatic bill pay, so I never, ever look at my DirecTV statement. And I never even go online and look at it because I know how much it's going to be, and it's all set up, and so good night, goodbye. So I'm looking at my online statement, and it says, thank you for your loyal service. You've been given 3 months of the complete Showtime package. And I'm like, hey, when did this kick in? Because there was no date on it, okay? So I'm like, I go downstairs. I'm like so excited. And I turn on the TV, and sure enough, you know, I click way down below the channels where I normally cruise, and there's like all these movie channels for free.
Cool.
And I think about all these weeks, you know, late at night, you're like, man, there is nothing on. Okay, there is nothing on this stupid TV. I can't believe the crap that they show over and over again. And sure enough, 3 days later it expired. Okay.
Yeah, the notice was a little late getting to you.
I caught it on the 87th day. But to me, the irony was, throughout that whole 3 months, every time I thought there was nothing on TV, I had this huge set of choices that I didn't even realize was there, and all I needed to do was scroll down. And those were sitting there, but I didn't know they were there.
Right.
It was just a complete failure of awareness. Now, that's analogy number one. I'm going to give another one. This is a story I heard a long time ago. I don't think it's true. It sounds like something that gets used in sermons and so forth. So,
ministerially speaking, yeah,
apocryphal. Okay, but
yeah.
It's a great story. Many years ago, probably late 19th, early 20th century, a man has booked himself passage from Europe to the United States. He's not a wealthy man. He's only able to just get the room and just barely that. So he knows it's a fairly long trip, and he's got people waiting for him on the other side, so he doesn't have to worry about getting his life started there. But he decides he'll just bring some food. So he gets himself a wheel of cheese and a bunch of crackers, takes it on board the ship, and this is what he's going to live on until he gets to America. So a day goes by, another day goes by, another day goes by. The cheese really dries out, and he can barely eat it. The crackers got weevils in them, and he's like, I'm out of food, and it's days yet until we're going to hit New York. He finds himself, walking along, seeing if anyone's left a plate behind with food on it. He walks by the dining room and just kind of looks in, and he sees people. They're eating, these wonderful feasts of roast chicken and steak and vegetables, and he's just, oh, I can't stand anymore. And finally, he goes to the bursar, and he says, look, I'm sorry. I didn't plan. I didn't think about it. I'll do anything. I'll wash dishes. I'll swab decks, but I have to have some food. I'm starving. And the bursar goes, meals are included. Right?
That's a great story. I love that.
Yeah, so it's that aha. That's the corner that we have to turn. It's, you got 12 movie channels down there, all right? The dining room is open, okay?
Along the same lines, Sally is saying in the chat room that fast breeding reactors are old news. The French have had them for years. So, see, that's another example. See, I hadn't even heard of them before. So,
well, I've heard of breeder reactors. I actually hadn't heard of fast breeder reactors. So, Sally, as always, way ahead of us. Thank you.
Yeah, ahead of the curve.
Okay, here's analogy number three. And this one I published in a blog comment. Oh, I got to find this now. This is another discussion with Will Brown. Will, by the way, posts over at wherethere'sawilliam.com, always worth reading. But we got in this discussion about, from Will's standpoint, it's not so much the leadership class that needs to change. It's business. It's our captains of industry who need to get on board and to make this leap. And that got me thinking, and I came up with this analogy. I said, imagine a tinker or a peddler, and he makes a living just selling odds and ends, this and that, to people who live in the nearby village. And the village is so destitute that by their standards, the tinker is actually pretty well off. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, little do any of these folks realize that their town sits atop the mother lode. All right? It's the richest vein of gold anyone has ever seen. Every little hovel in the village has a fortune sitting under it. Okay, and right next to the tinker's shack is the mouth of a cave that would open up the fortune both for him and the rest of them. All right, now what does the tinker do? Well, he spends his days thinking about how he can sell more tin cups and bits of string to the villagers, and he uses the mouth of that cave as a garbage dump.
Yep.
That's where we are, okay, right there. We're sitting on a gold mine here, all right, and we're going, gosh, I wish I could be as rich as the tinker. And the tinker's going, gosh, I wish I could get these folks to buy more string. Now, for the folks in the hovel, in their hovels in the village, that's us, it would be a lot harder to get to the gold. But we could, and we can. You know, it's just he's got the easy egress. He's got the way into it. And the question is he going to wake up one morning and realize it's sitting there?
Yeah. Well, and to some extent, I mean, that's actually literally the case in this country. I mean, we have natural gas sitting underneath us that that we could use.
I mean, that's it exactly with the
natural gas. That's exactly
right?
The situation.
It was
where
down there the whole time.
Right.
And we did, you know, the dining room has been open the entire time. I feel that way about geothermal after that discussion we had last week. But what's interesting is when you look at energy, or when you look at any of these other problems we're trying to solve, healthcare, any of them, there's never been so much leverage. Okay, there has never been so many wheels in motion at the same time. And that's really what we talk about at The Speculist, and when we write Better All the Time, and when we report on good news. The fact is that I think I've said this a few times before, that, you know, when I was a kid, there was a time when you would go 5-10 years without hearing about a major cancer breakthrough, without hearing about, wow, they've really come up with something interesting that sounds like it might really make a difference. How often do you hear about one of those now?
All the time.
Yeah,
in
you know,
fact,
when I started
I read about one right before the show.
Exactly. When I started blogging, it was like, well, you hear about them every month or so. And now it's like, I don't know, every week, every
yeah.
couple of days. They're coming all the time. And we've actually got a few examples of just things, Stephen, that without even knowing we were going to be talking about this, that you pulled together for the show tonight. So let's talk about these.
Okay, I'm going to run down a quick list. Over at Fight Aging, Reason, a friend of our blog, is writing about cancer treatments. Dr. Zwing Shui, who has been a guest on our show, and he continues to move forward with his care and being able to treat people with cancer using what is it called? Oh shoot. Granulocytes.
Granulocytes, yes.
Yes, you get a transfusion of somebody that has the ability within their blood to fight cancer, and it can be easily transfused. I mean, just as simple as a blood transfusion into someone who is currently fighting cancer, and the cancer goes away. And it's almost that simple. And the point is to be able to find the right granulocytes for the right cancer at this point, and research is proceeding quickly on that. So check that out over at Fight Aging. PJ Manny pointed to an article in The Economist about a new and much cheaper way to desalinate water. What's cool about that, let me see if I can get to it, it takes about one-third the power of the current way that's used to desalinate water. Instead of using 3.7 kilowatt hours of energy to produce 1,000 liters of drinking water, it will use 1 kilowatt of electricity to produce 1,000 liters of drinking water.
What a great example there. We
yeah.
talked, 3 weeks ago about your magic bottle that filters water.
Right.
You know, one
but
of
it's
one
no
of
good for seawater, though. It won't do that.
No, but what I was going to say is one of the leading causes of poverty, contributors to poverty in the world, is lack of abundant clean water.
Right.
And I don't know that in my entire life, in 30 years of my life, I ever heard about any breakthroughs in creating more clean water. And we talked about one a couple weeks ago, and now here's another one here.
Yeah, here is another one. Seawater desalination unit that can be scaled up to as big as you like. You know, it could be a huge plant providing water for an entire city. Or they think that they would be just as effective in a refrigerator-sized unit for a few houses.
Wow!
And
that's
so
amazing.
It really, really is. And I'm gonna and I'll have links to all these stories in the show notes. So make sure to check this out.
Well, we got some more too, right?
Oh yeah.
Let me talk.
Yeah,
about
yeah. Take a couple.
Okay, so we've got. Great! I stuck myself with this one. Tissue engineering a functioning penis. Now. Let's not, you know, once we're done Twittering, okay?
okay,
this
I'm
is,
done.
This, yeah, me too. This is amazing, okay? In a unique feat of tissue engineering, scientists from Wake Forest University, which, by the way, isn't that Zheng Sui's school?
Yes, it is.
He's a research scientist at Wake Forest as well. They're doing some interesting stuff at Wake Forest. Have created penile erectile tissue and implanted it into male rabbits, allowing the animals to, well, go at it like rabbits. Researchers implanted scaffolds needed with cells from rabbit penile tissue. 1 month later, organized tissue with blood vessels began to grow. Tests showed that the new tissue functioned like a normal penis with normal blood flow and drainage of the veins. The rabbits even fathered offspring.
That is remarkable. And, you know, that particular injury doesn't come up much. I mean, you know, it comes up so rarely it makes national news when – when it happens to a man, okay? That particular injury doesn't happen much. But we lose fingers all the time.
Exactly.
We lose hands and arms and feet and toes and things like that. And if you can figure out a way to allow an organism like a rabbit or a person to regrow a penis or something like that, then you know, how long until we're regrowing missing limbs?
Exactly. If you
this
can regrow,
is just remarkable.
Yeah, if you can regrow one external body part, which is what we're talking about here, you can regrow another. And it turns out, actually, the penis is a fairly simple one.
Yeah.
Compared to, like, a limb, which has joints in it and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, bones and nerves and things like that. Yeah, well, like a finger. But it's still, you would think that it's a step in the right direction, isn't it?
Yeah, and we have talked about tissue regeneration before, but this is, as far as I know, the first time anyone has ever regrown a body part on a mammal. And I think this is enormous, and I think we'll see a lot more of this kind of thing because, again, this stuff is just all coming a lot faster. It's coming much, much faster than it used to. So fast, really, one of the reasons I haven't done it better all the time in the last 6 months or so is I just get overwhelmed.
Right.
I start putting the list together, I'm like, wow, there is an awful lot of stuff to cover. Now, tell us about the LightSail 1.
Okay, it's a small bread box sized unit that's been sent up into low Earth orbit. It's going to deploy a sail, and it's going to be the first time. I found that surprising. I had thought that we had actually tested solar sails in one form or another at some point, but no. What we've had in the past is just solar power collectors. Okay?
Yeah, they collect energy, but they don't propel the
craft.
Satellite. Yeah.
What this is actually using solar wind, which is just the particles coming out from the sun, using that to push it, to push the craft. And this is the first time that's going to be tested. And so, the cool thing about solar wind is that there's you don't have to take your fuel with you. You know, you can go throughout the solar system moving around with just the power of the sun. And so that's remarkable. It's just like a normal sail. You don't have to go in just away from the sun. You can actually go towards the sun tracking just like you would with a normal sail. I found that interesting too, and that's also within that article at the New York Times.
So can you fly towards the sun with a solar sail?
Yeah, you would. You do like with a as you sail into the wind on the ocean, what do? You don't go you can't go directly into the wind, but you can
right.
go at an angle, and then you and then
oh,
you
and
come,
then take
come
another
about
pack,
it, and then you
okay.
go at another angle,
right.
and
okay.
so and you can so you could actually do the same thing with a solar sail.
Wow, so. it's very cool. And although I didn't provide a link and I didn't show it in the outline. This comes the same week that we see a $900,000 push prize awarded by NASA to engineers who have developed a good working prototype for the climber for a space elevator. I don't know if you saw that story.
I sure did. That's very, very cool because it's the first time I've ever awarded the prize. They've been having this, I think I wrote an article about it or wrote a post about it at The Speculus back when they first started this push prize. What was it, 2005?
I think so.
And they've had it annually ever since then, and no one's ever won any money because they never could get a climber that was that could climb fast enough. Well, now they have, and so, development continues apace. So really with that particular contest, they have it's broken down into two contests. Number one, a climber that can climb at a certain speed using light power, or and also the other part of the contest is creating tethers that are strong enough to be used as the building material for the space elevator, the ribbon.
Right.
So,
in this instance, the climber went up a line suspended from a helicopter was about 2,000 feet, but I mean that's all you need for a proof of concept to show that the idea.
And it was going along at a clip too, wasn't it? How fast was it going? I read it and I've forgotten since then.
I don't recall, but it was pretty impressive. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's still going to have to go a lot faster to make a reasonable trip out into space, but
it's like a meter a second though, and I was just imagining how fast that would be. You know, watching that just shoot up the line like that, I bet
that's
you
pretty
was
fast.
Neat to
yeah,
see.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so where does this put us, right? I think we've established that that we're sitting on a gold mine here. The cafeteria is open. You know, the Showtime channels are down there if we just learn how to work the remote, for crying out loud. Well, actually, before we turn to the next corner, let's bring Sally back in. And Sally, what's going on in the chat room? I see that there's a lot of interesting discussion. And before we lose it, you guys had the whole abortion issue all figured out there earlier. Is that correct?
Sally,
we don't hear you.
Okay.
Sally, you with us?
Well, you know, I think the problem was with me. Sally, are you there now?
Are you getting me now?
Yeah, we got you now. Sorry about that. That was me. Sorry.
Now, I've written about abortion before, describing how high-tech future reproductive technologies that would totally suppress fertility or completely make you fertile when you want to be, would, when totally distributed and totally developed, would completely end the need for abortion. Right now we have abortions because our contraceptives aren't all that workable a lot of times.
That is at least one very prominent reason. It's not the only reason, but certainly one major reason that we do.
Yeah.
People have to use them for them to be effective.
Yeah. You can't be just getting into those situations without preparing yourself. And then another thing we discussed was regrowing amputated limbs. And I definitely remember reading something very recently about this, that amputated limbs could be regrown with a certain technology. This was some brand new medical research that was going on, but I can imagine using something similar to what the penis topic was, that anything that could rebuild something that delicate could also rebuild an arm or a leg, I would think.
Well, you know, at the same time that, you know, doctors are working on solutions from one perspective, getting allowing us to I'm going to mute you, Sally, because I've got some feedback there. While doctors are working on one aspect of it to allow us to regrow amputated body parts, then, you know, you got DARPA, for example, working on a totally different solution. They call it their Luke Skywalker project, because what they want to do is have artificial limbs that look and feel and work just like our regular limbs would, like Luke Skywalker's robotic hand. So that's as you were saying, Phil, I mean, we have multiple possible solutions.
Yeah, and what I like about those two in particular, one is a problem that is considered so intractable that people just, they shrug. They go, there's no solution to this abortion thing, right? The two camps are completely at odds and opposed to each other, and there's just no good way to work it out. No one's ever going to be satisfied. But then when you start to think, oh, actually, there could be ways that technology might address this problem and greatly reduce what we're arguing about here, that's really encouraging. When you look at something like people who've lost limbs, the best solution anyone ever came up with 20, 30 years ago was just a very lame kind of prosthetic. And sorry, pardon the pun, but just a very ineffective kinds of prosthetics that they used to have before they started making these really remarkable breakthroughs in prosthetics, which I think are what's leading to the kind of research you're talking about, Stephen, in the Luke Skywalker Initiative, where eventually you have a fully automated, working, feeling artificial limb, right?
I think we ought to have a bet. Now's time for the bet.
Okay, go.
Okay, do we get a Luke Skywalker robotic hand or before we're able to regrow a hand? Which comes first? I mean, because once you're able to regrow a natural hand, presumably,
they'll probably slow down the Luke Skywalker research significantly.
Yeah, why would you want to, unless you just wanted something that was a lot stronger or something, something that had capabilities that a natural hand wouldn't have? Why would you do a Luke Skywalker hand if you could?
Well, you know, I don't have the link, but it seems like I read recently where they're very close now to a limb that moves, and, you know, I guess feeling is the big issue. So It's hard to bet against that one, but I think they'll leapfrog it. I think we'll have people growing limbs before they build the artificial replacement.
Sally in the chat room is she's going to bet for the regrown hand. Fully
okay.
Capable.
So
I'm with Sally on this one. I think.
We can't bet. We're on the same side.
Oh, okay. So, well, too bad.
Bet your world.
Well,
You know what? Just to make it interesting, I will therefore take the other side. I bet we'll have a robotic hand.
Okay. We're going to put $1 up. And
One U.S. dollar, okay, is riding on this. So, boy, come on, Skywalker Pro. Okay.
Okay.
So I think we've laid out the over the last couple of years, really 6 years since I've been working with the Speculus, we've made the case as best we can that that we're sitting at the edge of this stuff, that this is all really doable. So just to spin it back around to the question of, you know, how does people's thinking have to change? Where do we have to go with how we organize ourselves around these things? I want to refer to something we've talked about on the show before, and that we've talked about on the Speculus before, and that is the idea of dynamic optimism as outlined by Max Moore. Are you familiar with this, Stephen?
I think it's actually come up in the show before, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think we've talked about this at least once before. Max Moore put this together back in 98, and of course he's one of the founders of the whole Extropy movement, which of course is the predecessor to and sort of really the same thing as the transhumanist movement. And I think that he had probably been working on this before 98 when he published it, but this is the 1998 version that I'm referring to. And he talks about he's talking about this experience he had as a grad student at Cambridge and dealing with some really angry it was Oxford, not Cambridge, political protesters. So I'm sure, Stephen, not the kind you were.
I was quite civil, actually.
Oh, okay, well, there you go. Yeah.
I think the worst I went was kill the bill. That's about as violent as I got.
Okay. Well, that's if you took the out of there, you'd have a movie title, for crying out loud. he talks about how gloomy they were, how pessimistic they were, and how they would move from one issue to the next, always, pardon the expression, pissed off, right? They're just, you know, they're always against something, always opposed to something, always mad about something. And he said it occurred to him that probably wasn't the right attitude. That wasn't the attitude that's going to get us to where we need to be. And he put together this idea that he called dynamic optimism. So it's not just thinking, hey, good things are going to happen, or gosh, positive outcomes are possible. It's it's really a systematic approach to how we need to look at the world. There's this quote from Hamlet. I'll try not to get it wrong. More things are dreamt of in heaven and earth there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio. That's the issue. I think that's what we're talking about, Steve. There's just more stuff out there than people have considered. And I think the word philosophy is well chosen there. I think that we've got a philosophy gap for dealing with the world. We've got a very contentious and kind of bipolar way of looking at issues, and a very tending towards negative way of looking at them. And I think there's another way we can go.
I think that this fuels the cynicism that so many people, left and right, have towards our leadership in this country. The truth is that this society has become so complex that it seems like our leaders are just so out of touch. Well, it's impossible for any one person to stay in touch on all these different things, and you got too many balls to juggle. You know, and the balls are interacting in so many different ways, and you know, everyone's got a busted crystal ball. Nobody knows how these things all interact together, and so you know, I think it comes down to this. Glenn Reynolds published a book a few years back called Army of Davids, which is just an outstanding book, and really in it he takes on this idea that central planning just is not going to get it done anymore. The world's too complex. You can't micromanage from the top down any longer. So what do we have to do? Well, what we end up what works best, seems to work best, is a society that's free enough that you allow individuals to pursue their own goals, and in a sort of distributed, dynamic fashion, so that maybe no one person can see the whole picture anymore, but they know that okay, here's what I need to do for my little portion of the of what needs to happen, and so that's I think that's kind of where we're going.
It's almost a question of, it's not even optimism at that point. It's what it takes to put that in place is a level of confidence.
Yeah, faith that it's going to be okay.
Yeah, and I think the things that Moore talks about here actually fit into that very nicely. He talks about, first off, interpreting your experiences in a positive way, and he talks about having a selective focus. Trying to stay on what's constructive and open and enjoyable, not complaining all the time, particularly the kind of pointless kind that just gets you nowhere, always questioning limits. And I guess that's a big part of what we do, right? We don't take a limit, a set limit, as a given. And as we've actually demonstrated here with just a few examples tonight, a lot of things that were once believed to be limits just aren't. A sense of abundance, and it's interesting how that word abundance has become so important within the transhumanist movement. Feeling free to do what you want rather than feeling compelled by circumstances or people. I mean, really, that feeling belongs to someone who's not being centrally managed, right? That is the feeling of someone who has responsibility for their own life.
Right.
And most importantly, humor.
which we try to demonstrate with every show. Yeah.
Absolutely. We've always got that to fall back on, we hope. And then just very quickly, he talks about once you're experiencing that way, how are you going to influence outcomes positively? And he talks about being rational, self-improving, experimental, self-confident, exuding self-worth, taking personal responsibility, and selecting your environment. All very much, I think you would agree, Stephen, the kinds of things that fit in nicely with the idea of people who are free, who are responsible for their own lives, as opposed to those who are kind of having everything set out for them.
Absolutely.
So I think our two ideas have kind of dovetailed here in a very nice way, thanks to Max Moore. So we're out of time. We will, I'm sure, come back to these ideas again soon, but I feel like if we're no closer to solving the energy problem, we're probably closer to solving the whole human problem here.
Okay. Well, that ain't bad for 1 hour. So
yeah, we'll have to settle for that. So what do we got going on music-wise this evening?
The song is "Open Road" by Nathan Lee.
Nathan Lee singing "Open Road." Well, what a perfect ending to this discussion of the open road that lies before us. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thank you, Sally, and all our friends in the chat room, everyone listening to us live, and everyone who listens to us via MP3. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again this time next week. And until then, don't miss it.
never thought I'd get this far.